from KFNX News Talk Radio 1100. It's Chatterbox, where you'll find the latest news, interviews, and updates about the gaming world. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host, the guests, and callers only, and not necessarily those of KFNX News Talk Radio 1100. And now, here's your hosts for Chatterbox.
We are in the studio, Chatterbox Video Game Radio. My name's Alon.
And my name's Ara.
And my name is Rich.
And I'm Michaela.
Michaela came in. She wanted to show up again.
Why are you here, Michaela?
Because I hate you, Rich.
I can see the sparks traveling across the room.
I knew it!
And they're not sparks of love. They're sparks of seething hatred coming out of his eyes.
That's the stuff that good shows are made of.
That's right.
So I think the real reason is that I talked about last week getting Little Big Planet.
Yes.
Now, I had only been able to play it like once prior to the show.
How many more weeks would you like to talk about this?
Every day.
Computer on.
Yeah, that's what happened.
Nicely done.
Pretty much all the time.
All the time. That's what I figured.
Yeah, but it's because it's worth it. Now, you were upset that I talked about it so much prior to it releasing.
Well, I'm just upset that you're not getting kickbacks from the developer. You know?
No, but it turned out to be as good as I expected. It actually has a little thing I don't like, but I understand in terms of the control. But you learn to deal with it. And the game is just, it's killer.
It seemed pretty good to me.
It's fun.
It's so all good right. That Michaela wanted to come in and talk about her experience.
That's fantastic.
It is the best game ever.
Can
we mention what's happening, what fantastic surprise is happening in our second segment?
It's not much of a surprise because we mentioned last week that we would be having a guest.
Surprise!
Yeah, but we know that all of our listeners will have forgotten, and so now it's a surprise to them.
Okay. Feel free.
So, John Dean from EA Salt Lake will be with us starting in our second segment, and we're going to have lots of interesting conversations.
But because we'll be talking about him later, we need to talk now about Little Big Planet.
Fair enough, my friend.
We have a limited time.
That's what I like to hear.
Michaela came in because she wanted to talk about liking it, right? She doesn't get to play too many games. Really, she gets to. She chooses not to.
That's because the other games are not fun. This is quite possibly the most fun game I've ever encountered in my entire life.
Well, you liked Braid, but you didn't do much playing. You just watched it, right?
Is this before drinking or after drinking?
Yes.
This is after with no
both.
Drinking.
Before, during, and after.
Both during and after. Okay, well.
You can really do it anytime.
So part of the beauty of this game, at least from her perspective, and I assume from other people's.
You can dress the characters up.
Yeah.
That is key.
That's dude, okay.
Not only that.
Ponytails on my face.
I'm not supposed to tell dudes that that's why I like the game. I'm supposed to be tough and hard.
This is correct. You're not supposed to tell them this.
Yeah.
But what she told me in the car on the way here is that not only does she like to dress up her characters, which I already knew, she actually likes to change the outfit based on the level.
That's very interesting. This is
like
this
I bet
is,
you and I would not have
no,
thought,
no,
I would
every,
not have
this is
it.
This is fantastic insight into your female demographic, all of you publishers out there, and maybe even John Dean will take note.
And that's why I brought it up. It's not just that she wanted to dress him up, because that part we knew. We knew they liked to play dress up. They'd like
but
to have
per,
Sims
per level, because of course, you how could you not go out with an appropriate attire?
Well, listen, if there's
how
a bouncy,
could you not?
If there's a bouncy level with lots of trampolines,
you have to wear the wedding dress.
I have to wear the wedding dress
because it has a train.
Is it because you like to see what's under this dress?
That's part of it.
That's part. Yeah.
The lion tail is key on that level.
Yeah, and we take photos of her in the air bouncing.
Yeah, we did.
But then if you play a level with the skateboard going down a big old ramp,
you have to wear like the fairy dress because it would just not be practical to wear a wedding dress in that scenario.
All right,
this logic is amazing.
Isn't it?
I love it.
If we played a level in outer space, I'm sure she would use the astronaut costume, which, by the way, is downloadable right now.
Michaela could host like Little Big Planet character dressing tips. Like,
actually,
we could start a new podcast.
Like, yeah. Like, this week in Michaela's Little Big Planet, I don't know.
All right, let's not get too excited.
I really think that if you're going to go into outer space, though, the swimsuit would be the appropriate choice. I'm just going to throw that out there.
I will concur with that, but I want to hear from you, now that you had substantial experience with the game. I presume. I don't want to put words into your
mouth. I got to play the Gradius level, man.
Okay, so
before it got taken down.
So what is can you characterize to me, because I've watched this game for about 15 minutes, right? Looks promising, but you characterize to me why this is such a good game.
All right, well, first of all, we all know that I like platformer games. Historically, I have enjoyed platformer style games.
Did you like Bubsy, though?
No.
Okay, then good.
But here's the thing, like, I like good ones. Because they...
Okay, I just wanted to see if you had a hard-on for all platformer games.
No, because a lot of them suck, because they're just trying to be something they're not. But a good one will present a challenge both physically, like it's hard to jump on that tiny little sliver of a platform successfully without falling off, right? So that's more of the physical challenge.
Right.
And they should also involve some sort of puzzle element where you have to figure out what to do, not just how to do it.
Okay, I have a severe disagreement with that, but I let you continue.
Yeah, I'm just telling you what makes me enjoy it, right?
Sure, okay.
And then also having a varied experience from level to level. I don't want every level to just be, oh, it's difficult to jump
certainly.
On that sliver.
You right. don't want to just eat 10 chicken nuggets. You want to have the fries and the Coke.
Well, I'm okay with chicken nuggets, but they're going to have different sauce.
There you go.
Spicy mustard. Yeah.
So that's, I think, some of the things that make a platforming game fun and interesting, right? Then making it multiplayer, I can't remember a platform game that I've played that was multiplayer in the same way this is. Or really, I can't even think of any multiplayer platform game.
You know what I actually thought of when I was watching the game? I'm like, oh, this is like The Lost Vikings, except without special abilities. Which I don't know if you get that reference. But
I know what Lost Vikings is.
Yeah,
but Lost Vikings was a single-player game.
Yeah, but you can imagine that other
was there? Was there? Control. Could you play two-player and have one person control?
No, I don't think that would have made sense the way they did it. So, yeah.
So I mean, that was a one-player game where you control three people.
Right.
And you choose which one you're controlling at what time.
Just pretend that my imagination is correct.
So I disagree. But this game is so good. There are parts where you need two people, or it's helpful to have more than two people, go perform a function.
But
in order
do you have
to? Stuff.
Do you have to have two people to get past any point?
There are
certain stuff.
Not past. They don't ever give you an obstacle that needs to be overcome that also requires multiple people.
Yeah.
But they have little side quest things or parts of a level that can only be dealt with multiple people.
I see.
Right. So if you want to get the stuff that's really high, you need someone to bounce on this dude's stomach so that the other character can get shot up with something else, right? Or you need to step on a button while the other person goes, you know, beyond the door that's opened by the button.
Right.
That's a more simple implementation of it. And I've actually been thinking in my head of a level, or at least a portion of a level, some sort of play mechanic that I would like to implement in a level that I may create. I haven't done any of the level creation stuff at all.
So this I'm impressed with, because it's funny, because the game, the hook of the game, right, is this level creation thing, but the awesomeness of it has nothing to do with this, right? And in fact, like, I think about, like, how long it's been since, like, a decent platformer has come out, and it just seems like a really long F in time, right?
Well, yeah.
It's almost like platformers themselves, like, had this, like, stigma, like, they were so played out that nobody dared put, like, one out again unless it had a really, really interesting hook.
Well, it's hard to do it well, and it became more difficult when they went 3D, right? So Mario Galaxy came out, and that was a good game.
Yeah.
It was a little under-recognized.
Well, I don't think
it
necessarily got more difficult. I think that just developers and maybe publishers were obliged to only do it in 3D, which is crazy in most cases.
Yeah. Well, these days, yeah, you're not going to get a lot of attention without being 3D. But, I mean, Braid obviously did it.
Right.
2D.
Well, Little Big Planet, I mean, obviously the assets aren't 3D, but the interaction is essentially in two dimensions with a few layers.
There are a few layers, but yeah, mostly 2D. And that's really important, because in order to drive a player towards action, you can't give them the ability to walk around
action. It's too much to think about.
Yeah.
You know, you can't. It's too little to see.
And that's why, like in the original Mario 64, there wasn't a lot of action in the game. You weren't ever fighting enemies. Well, you were rarely fighting enemies because you could just walk around them.
Right.
And they realized you have to sort of bottleneck it and force them into action scenarios. But Little Big Planet, yeah, level creation is sort of the whole point. But we've enjoyed just playing through the pre-made levels, but then also going online and playing other people's levels, where somebody makes Little Ninja Warrior. And I get to play this level that's modeled after a TV show. And there's American Gladiators version and all this stuff. Or just interesting levels people make with the human body. I put a video on our website just last night or the day before. And if we have time later, remind me, and I may tell you my idea for something that requires all four players in order to get past, you know, if I build this level.
Right on.
I'll make it. I'll put a video up maybe. Or no video. I don't know. I'll make it and tell the listeners about it. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Arizona's News Talk Leader, KFNX News Talk Radio, 1100.
All right, we're back. It's Chatterbox Video Game Radio, and we're going to have John Dean on in hopefully a few moments.
But before that...
Before we get to that, yes.
A couple things to mention. First of all, you wanted to mention the phone number.
866-536-1100 if you want to talk to John Dean from EA Salt Lake, or if you just want to pester us.
That's right. And we also need to mention that next week, we may or may not have a show, and this is based solely on the performance of apparently the University of Arizona's basketball team.
So maybe we should like talk to some of the higher ups there.
I don't know.
Get things in order.
Rumor has it that if they do well, they will continue to play and then take us off the air.
So hope they lose?
Yes.
Okay.
Certainly. Devout listeners of the program will be used to this because it's happened with hockey and other stuff. So we're on at such a desirable time slot. That,
this makes me feel good.
Yeah.
I like this characterization.
So anyway, we really will only know on Tuesday. I won't even be able to give advance warning. So kind of sucks, but oh well. I'll put something up on the website saying no show.
And where do you think many of these listeners might have gone to school, possibly?
Our radio listeners?
Yeah.
Maybe the University of Arizona?
Maybe.
All right.
Or how about another institution?
The people in the chat room are complaining that I'm talking about about Little Big Planet too much. So they win, and we will move on to another discussion.
As scheduled.
Although I'm sure we have plenty of listeners.
We'll talk about Little Big Planet more next week.
You're just lucky that I haven't talked about how crappy PlayStation Network is.
Yeah,
the fact
it is.
That it takes us 10 tries just to download an update so that I can then go online. But I will digress. And before we bring on John, just mention UAT, University of Advancing Technology.
Fantastic school.
Our wonderful sponsor. And now, without further ado.
John, are you with us?
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, guys.
All right, he is with us.
You're on the air, sir.
Okay. Hello, Arizona.
So, let's see. Why don't we start by, since maybe some of our listeners may not be familiar with you, if you can tell us a little bit about your background and your current job.
Certainly, guys. First of all, just to say how nice it was to hear you guys arguing earlier. sounds like mom and dad fighting. I'm what's called an executive producer. I'm at EA's newest studio, which is in Salt Lake. I work for a group that's making games based upon our new Hasbro business. I've been in the games industry for about 150 years and started back in the days of the Atari video computer system, but you guys probably weren't born when that was around.
I've been making games
ever since.
How young do you think I am?
Maybe one or two of us, or we can't speak for the rest.
We were just commenting on Ara's gray hair before the show. So.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Snap.
By the way, I've actually invited one of my producers from the studio, Jeff Peters, to phone in as well. He's probably waiting if you want to bring him in too.
Oh, I think he's already on with us, actually.
He's been in the industry for about 100 years, so not quite as long as I have.
That's fantastic. It's like a party line.
You guys are old.
Okay, so the guy who was born during Atari.
I'm just saying.
You know what? I bet Ara's got more gray hair than me.
I won't argue that.
Am I on as well now?
Yes.
Oh, hi. Hey, this is Jeff Peters. How you doing?
How's it going, Jeff?
So far, so good this evening. And, John's right. He has been in the industry about 50 years longer than me.
All right, fantastic. So the whole impetus for this conversation that we were about to have was me and John were having actually a really interesting conversation some time ago about the stigma. I don't want to kind of like taint this conversation too early, but I guess I will already.
Good stuff.
This is the stigma of tie-in games, right? And, you know, I want to talk about it generally because there's all kinds of different tie-ins, but also kind of like specifically on what tie-ins are not normally associated with what the normal game industry demographic considers cool, right? Like, I don't know, Care Bears or something.
Can we start with some classic examples so our listeners get a feel for this? Like,
yeah,
what was an old good tie-in?
So I have a good way to start this up, right? So I remember when I was a kid and, you know, back in the days when games weren't as, I don't know, I guess as commercialized, if that makes any sense, as they are now. And, you know, there were games like, Mickey Mouse Castle of Illusion, if anybody remembers that one. On Genesis.
That's actually a big one.
When I was a kid, we didn't really seem to, at least my personal experience was that we didn't really care too much about what the subject matter of the game was. We didn't really seem to care about, is this barbarian guy cool? Is it okay for me to play this game? You know, is Mickey Mouse cool enough? Is it okay for me to play the Mickey Mouse game? I mean, they were just like, okay, we had these games and we played them, right? I mean, we didn't really have much even in the room of discriminating between.
Are you talking about coolness factor?
Yeah, coolness factor is part of it, right? We didn't really seem to have a lot of that just because our access to games was relatively limited.
Well, clearly not, considering Yonoid was one of the crowning jewels in your collection.
Well,
you could even go back further, go back to the ColecoVision days with the Smurf game. I mean, who would have thought gamers playing, you know, Smurf, yet that was highly popular and everybody loved it?
There you go. The Smurf game I hated. Yonoid, I actually hated.
That's actually a great example of a bad tie-in game.
Right, right. But there were...
So the 7-up ET on the 2600, that was another great one,
but
right?
ET, there you go, right? But the interesting thing was that, at least, you know, amongst my group of friends, when I was a kid, we very quickly learned that, okay, there are some of these games that have these kinds of, like, what we would otherwise consider silly premises were really, really awesome. You know, like, Mickey Mouse Castle of Illusion was a fantastic game. Like DuckTales on the regular Nintendo.
Also very good.
Also fantastic. You know, I mean, we very quickly learned that that was better than, you know, some gigantic, you know, shirtless, I don't know, muscular dude with a sword, like Sword of Sodan on the screen where you couldn't even move him around, right?
Or if you want to run a really weird advertising tie-in, the 7-Up Spot games on the Genesis made by Virgin.
I mean, those were actually... very well received, were they not?
Yeah, a great platform game, great animation, but one of the most odd licenses to throw at a video game. Or, to even get weirder, there was a McDonald's license game on the Genesis.
I knew you were going there.
That's true.
Or something like that.
And in fact, the McDonald's game, if I'm not mistaken, that was developed by Treasure.
Yeah.
I think it was.
Which is one of the developers that I hold in highest regard, personally.
The McDonald's game on the NES was awesome.
What's that? We missed that part.
I was saying that Treasure makes the most bizarre, quirky game mechanics known to man.
Yeah, they do. But
are you referring to Stretch Panic?
Oh, there's a great example.
So, Ari, your point here is that, is there a stigma associated with games that have any kind of license or branding associated with them? Maybe why would that be? And I think if you think about it, you mentioned some games that... had brands or licenses associated with them, and that you were very good. I would suggest that, you know, anytime you make a game, you still got to make a game, right? And it doesn't mean to say that that game's going to be bad just because it has a license. It just so happens that I think perhaps in the late 80s, early 90s, when gaming really started to become a mass market proposition, I think the marketing types out there realized that licenses actually helped sell games, that consumers would really buy anything that had those brands on them, and consequently they didn't put so much effort into making great games. They would basically put shovelware out there, and I think that's when you started to see a lot of licensed products that were substandard, and that's when consumers got burned, and perhaps that's what started the stigma you talk about. There are also some great examples of where there have been some licensed products, though, even in recent years, that actually you'd say are world class and leading. You could look at Pokemon, for example, as a toy brand that was extremely well executed, and now you wouldn't think twice about playing.
You can also look at examples of, you know, how gameplay has actually changed the perception of a license, and I think the Lego series is probably one of the best recent examples.
Yeah, I actually had that on my list to bring up.
Have been, you know, really bad to play, and you know, there's finally a good one out there, starting with the, you know, Lego Star Wars series.
So one question I wanted to ask you guys, I have this planned for a little bit later, but now that you brought it up, is why do you think the Lego games were so successful? Right? Was it the Star Wars, or was it the Legos, or was it in spite of the Legos, or you know any combination thereof, or something else?
I would say, go ahead, John. I was going to say that I think if you think just generally trying to work out, well, what matters, if you think about Lego and what your associations are with Lego. So if you think Lego and as a customer, what excited you about Lego from playing it, particularly when you were younger? And then what do you like about Star Wars? So on the one hand, it's kind of the experience of building with Lego. And on the other hand, with Star Wars, it's the fiction that you feel warmly about. And the smart thing about the Lego games, at least the recent ones, has been the fact that from a design point of view, they were able to use those nice familiar things you had about those brands actually in their game design, and the game design pushes those buttons of familiarity all the time. So I hope that's not getting too far away from the point, but I think that's a big underlying reasons why those games have been successful. They really understood what you cared about deep down about those brands. They still have to build a credible game on top of that.
Well, one thing that I'm curious about, like, I didn't play a lot of the LEGO Star Wars, but as far as I know, you don't actually build stuff. You just watch LEGOs that fall apart and get rebuilt and then play a Star Wars game.
That's right.
I think that's one of the coolest things about it is when you look at, you know, both the young kids and, you know, us still build LEGO kits.
Hold that thought. We got to go to break. We got a hard block here. We'll be right back after the break, everyone.
It's me, Mario. You're listening to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. It's a number one. Woohoo!
All right, we're back. And we're just continuing on with our guests, John Dean. And
I'm sorry, I forgot the other gentleman's name in our rapid arguments over the break.
It's Jeff.
Jeff. All right.
Now, before we went to break, we were talking about, the subject of LEGO. LEGO Star Wars came up, right, as an example of a good licensed game. And you guys were saying that part of it is the LEGO license that makes it good because it brings you this nostalgia of what it was like to use LEGO. And my argument there is actually that you don't actually do anything relating to the activity you had when you were a child playing with LEGO because that's building stuff. And in this game, you don't actually build anything. So I was wondering if you agree there, like, how do you feel about that?
I think one of the things to, you know, consider with that is, although that you're not building or constructing, I mean, there are many kits that you do, which is sort of a bonus item, but it plays out one of the fantasies is we build all these complex kits at home, you know, some of these things being a $300 Death Star. How cool is it now to be able to play with them in the video game, tear them down, and have the game rebuild them for us? Where if we did that in real life, think of the number of hours it would take to tear them down and rebuild them. So it actually allows this kind of weird fantasy of, wow, I get to play with my own Star Wars kits. Plus, it has, we've seen so many games in the Star Wars galaxy, it's the first one to actually poke fun at it. Doesn't treat it as completely reverent. So all of the cutscenes have no voice, no licensed actors, and they poke fun at these scenes that we all hold near and dear, and then has a humorous take on it. So hey, they're not that hallowed. They're fun. And then you add to that the fact that, you know, we can play together, and, you know, fathers and sons play together. I think it's a wonderful mix.
All right, I'll buy that. And now
use of the license is what it is, and it doesn't mean. I think that's actually one of the tricks of the point I was trying to make was that it doesn't have to be a literal translation of what you might believe the brand to be. So it's actually doing more with it. So something a bit more obvious, we've just shipped a game called The Littlest Pet Shop, which will be of no interest to most of your listeners, being the fact that they'll be male, but to your younger sisters, aged 8 to 9, it will be perfect for them, because that's who the games, who the toys are aimed at, and what we've done is we've then taken those toys and brought them to life on screen. That's a far more literal translation of using a license that way. But there's many ways you can do it to do it effectively and be successful with them. You know what, if it's done right, the game can still matter, and the game is actually stronger through leveraging what you like about those brands.
And so, looking historically at the glut of games, of licensed games that were actually bad, is there a universal collection of thought that explains why they were bad, and then an intentional avoidance of those things? Like, when I look at it, I realize, okay, E.T. and, I mean, that's the prime example, E.T. and all the other licensed games that were bad tend to be bad basically because they're coinciding with a release of something else in that brand, and therefore time is limited for the developers.
The really strange thing about that is that the only reason you can make the association with licenses and bad games is because you can group those games together with a license. There have been an awful lot of very bad original games, too, but you don't think really of grouping those together and saying, well, all the unlicensed games that were poor, ultimately, that comes down to, you know, their poor game design, or their game designs that just don't work, or just who've been poorly executed, or whatever it happens to be. You know, it's not simply the fact that they were licenses that was the condition there.
But there's a difference, though. When you're given a good license, there's so much potential for good gameplay that's just obvious. You know, you give me Indiana Jones or Batman or whatever, and mm-hmm. I don't need to put thought into what this game is going to be like.
I just never thought into actually developing it.
I think that's exactly the point. That's why you end up making a bad game, because you assume it's going to be easy and straightforward and the work's done for you.
Yeah, I actually think that's a good point.
That E.T. actually, I think, started this whole wave. And that's E.T., if I remember right, was start to finish like around 3 months. It was, here's this great license, slap it together and get it out the door. And I think we still have that problem as an industry, that sometimes, you know, you just have very little time. Like the movie industry can create a movie start to finish in 6 to 9 months. To do an Xbox 360 game justice in that same time frame, working with that license as it's evolving, is probably one of the most difficult things that we could undertake.
Yeah, you know what else I think it is? I just thought that, you know, we seem to have a lot of expectation when there's some kind of, you know, subject or IP or whatever that's already out there.
Yep.
Right? And so this expectation, I think, suddenly colors, you know, if a lot of times if we don't get what we expect, even though it might be intrinsically good, we might still think it's bad, right? Like one of the games I worked on, the Red Star, which we bring up incessantly on this show, basically it was a tie-in to a comic, right? And what we did was we decided, okay, in order for this to be a good game, we need to actually ignore the narrative of the comic because it's essentially not a narrative game, and just make the best game that we can think of making, right? Yeah. And so really, like, it didn't follow, I mean, it followed the narrative in a cursory way. You know, I mean, the whole tie-in was essentially just a wrapper for the subject matter of the game, but it was not the subject matter at all, really. I mean, it didn't tell you anything about what the game was actually like in terms of actually the interaction and playing it, right? So the interesting thing was that we got very, very mixed reviews when the game finally came out. One of the ones that stuck in my mind the most was one where basically this guy was a Red Star comic fan, right? So, which had suddenly become our greatest enemy, because he expected so much from the narrative that he completely dismissed all the other things that were good about it, because he was so focused and hoping and wishing that, you know, his expectation, his wish of the narrative somehow came alive in this game, which it totally didn't fulfill at all.
Yeah, and I think that's the tough kind of over the very thin rather line that you walk when you're doing a licensed property, is on the one hand, you know, how literal do you want to be with it? Because if you're literal, then the chances are it's not going to work in the same media,
right.
Or in a different media to the one it was designed for. And then if you then take your creative license with it and you try to make it work, then of course you risk alienating the people who are very interested in that license from the get-go, because they're fans of it. And that's really why, you know, doing a good job with licensed products and making them meaningful in effectively a different media to the one they were created in, that's why it becomes a trick. And so that's a large part of what EA Salt Lake's been set up to do, is to become expert at that. I wouldn't say we're expert now, but I would say that exactly what you described, it's that it's trying to get that fine line walked in an effective way. It's a tough thing to do, and I think a lot of customers out there, you know, think it's a straightforward thing to do and it must be easy. It's actually not. I'd liken it to, so if you read a good book, you know, something maybe a thriller or something that's really engaged you, and it comes out in a movie and you go and see it and they've changed the ending or something, and you go, well, that was sucked, you know.
Right, or they add characters.
Yeah, yeah.
They make orcs talk that don't talk normally.
Right. So the disappointment you feel is ultimately what our customers feel when we do the wrong thing with their license. So really not understanding or valuing the things that are key about the license can actually hurt you when you're trying to do the thing that you think is right, which is make a better game.
Yeah, and the point that I was trying to make before, which is essentially what Jeff mirrored, was basically that you're given a time frame. Sometimes you're given a very strict time frame, and it ruins it for you because it's just too tight. Whereas if you consider some of the examples of games we gave that were actually good and licensed, they didn't coincide with something with such a strict date, like you know, the Mickey Mouse game.
Right.
It didn't match the video because it came out 20 years earlier or something.
Right.
And
right.
The 7-Up Spot game didn't have any. Red Star didn't really tie in too much with the release. I mean, it wasn't. Comic number 50 is going to also have a video game associated with it, right? So they had the time to develop their project and didn't have such a strict time frame that, okay, you have to bang this out in 6 months, that it was able to also be good. Right.
I think that's part of it. I think maybe one other side effect, and maybe you guys can speak to this as well, just because I'm just talking out of my butt here, but I don't know. I just get the sense that, you know, maybe for licenses that aren't necessarily the biggest licenses, you know, you tend to maybe not get the best talent working on those games. And so maybe that might have an overall effect on, you know, what kind of product comes out.
Well, I mean, with any license, there's going to be a fan base. And, you know, one of the tricks is to get the people that see what you can do with it, that see that vision. Whether it's a tiny license that we grow that can actually transcend wherever it came from, or taking something big and taking a new direction. If you can get that passion around it, you know, you can do great things with it. But no matter what game it is, whether it's licensed or not, you still have to have a team that sort of shares that vision. And if they don't, it doesn't matter what it is. You're not going to have a good game coming out the back end.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. We got another break coming up. Stay with us for one more segment. We'll wrap it up and be done with the show.
We're back. It's Chatterbox Video Game Radio, and we're with John Dean and Jeff from EA Salt Lake. You guys still hanging on there?
Still here.
All right.
Still here.
So I wanted to go back to Lego Star Wars for a second.
Thanks.
Because we were actually having an argument off the air about how I thought it was actually a horrendous design, and let me be very, very precise about what I mean by that. The actual gameplay design I thought was incredibly sloppy because there's almost no consequence whatsoever to any action or mistake or anything that you do. But then we start thinking about it, and I'm glad you guys keep bringing up the word trick, because this is almost like an ingenious trick that they've pulled off. Because even though the mechanics, at least, I don't know, to a designer, just seem just horrendous and sloppy, it seems like it directly works in the game's favor.
So what would you define as a sloppy part of the mechanics? You know, thinking of a level.
Well, for example, if I can recall as best as I can, you know, one of the levels where you're going around shooting, they have just so many things shooting at you that you can't hope to avoid all of them. And in fact, it doesn't even matter. You know, you have this massive amount of health. You're walking around. Okay, this guy's hitting you. Okay, that guy's hitting you. Okay, maybe I'll shoot this guy. Maybe I'll shoot that guy later. And it's just a lot of the situations are very chaotic, right? And so they give you enough health to kind of sustain damage throughout the whole thing, but they don't seem to really seriously expect you to actually dodge all those things. Whereas, you know, in a game that handled the mechanics better, you know, they would actually equip you with the means to do that kind of dexterity, and at the same time, you know, not overload you all at once.
So the thing I would say with that is that's not. Yeah, that may be design that evolved, but I wouldn't call it sloppy, because one of the things that really, really works about the game is you're not focused on death. The goal of the game is not necessarily to survive from the beginning of the level to the end. It's actually to unlock as much stuff as possible, from the characters to the kits to the mini-kits to whatever. And if you play the game beginning to end, it only unlocks about 30% of the game. So the real game of LEGO Star Wars actually begins after you finish it, which is using all the characters to go unlock and find more stuff. So it's like they almost give you that first 30% of the game because you're not worried about dying. And actually, I think that works really, really, really well for, you know, mass market, Nintendo crowd, father and son, kids playing together. They just have a blast going back again and again to experience that.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing that I thought that was an ingenious trick about it was that, you know, it's, under normal circumstances, I'd say, like, okay, like, it's bad for you to get hit a lot and there to be no penalty to that, right? If you make a mistake. In this game, everything's kind of like flattened in that way, right? Like, there's not a lot of consequence to your mistake, you know? But it's almost okay, because it's like, it's more of kind of like, I don't know, like a gallery tour or something. And
so on that point, Ira, I think one of the things that you got to remember there is that, you know, we, in the industry, we got used to designing games for ourselves for so many years, games that we would want to play, and we would kind of follow the norms of game design, if you think of it that way. We kind of got used to them. And that when you're designing games for a wider or different audiences, and LEGO Star Wars would fall into that broader category, then you're going to find that some things are going to not matter to some of your customers, and it's really understanding where they are. And hey, I'm not defending the game design of that product; it's not one of mine. But at the same time, it seems to have worked for LEGO Star Wars, and they don't seem to have alienated the vast majority of people who bought the game. So as a designer, I would challenge you to say, so is there learning for us in that, right?
No, absolutely. I mean, I'm saying that it's a good quality after all. You know, I mean, it was definitely not something that, you know, your point is taken.
I think what he's trying to say is know your audience, which is a classic
right.
rule.
Right, right. Absolutely.
And I think I'd add one thing to John's statement, and that's to look at, you know, Nintendo and the Mario games, because they actually follow something similar to Lego Star Wars, where you're not as worried about death, because in all the Mario games, it's so easy to get extra lives. I mean, you very rarely have a game over because, all right, I tried and failed, and I bring a new Mario back, and I keep going. And I think Lego Star Wars hits that, you know, that sort of same nerve as well.
So now I'm going to change subjects for a minute. We only have a little bit of time left, but we got a question in from one of our listeners over the live chat at our website, chatterboxgameshow.com. He's using Spider-Man Web of Shadows as an example of a licensed game that is not tied to a specific product in the marketplace, right? Like, it's not tied to Spider-Man 3 or Spider-Man 2 or something. And his question is basically, like, it starts off with the assumption that the game Spider-Man Web of Shadows looks like junk. And from that, you could just say it either looks like junk or plays like junk or isn't as good as it could have been. And his question is this because the licensor takes such a big chunk of the money involved in coming into the game that they just don't have enough money to put into development? Or is it that the developers realize it doesn't really matter because it is a licensed game, we'll just sell a certain number to the devout fans of Spider-Man, doesn't really matter how hard we try? Or is there some other excuse that might allow a game like this to fly under the radar and just not actually be as good as it could have been? Do you have any sort of response?
Hard for us to comment, have not been involved in that game. I'm sure every game has its own story, but I would hazard a guess that it's really nothing to do with the cost of the license or the money you pay to the licensor, because those deals are usually on a royalty basis, which means the company doing the licensing gets more money the more it sells. So it's not in their interest to have a poor quality game go out there. So I doubt that becomes a limiting factor. I can't remember who made that game, but ultimately the earlier point around time comes into play, and it's whether they really understood the Spider-Man, the comic strip or any of the various forms it's taken over the years, and whether they were true to that in any way in the game. I suspect the game sucked because it wasn't a good design.
Yeah. I actually don't know how much the game sucked. He was complaining specifically about the graphics.
Yeah, he complains a lot.
Yeah, but I'm trying to say oftentimes there are many licensed games and there's something that's faulty in it, whether it be everything, the graphics, the gameplay, the design, or perhaps just one point. And in this case, you could easily say, well, if you threw more money at it, it could have been more graphically impressive. But,
you know, I've seen games that have had a lot of money thrown at them and a lot of time spent on them, and, you know, they can still be very poor. So I think that you need to actually dig deeper into an individual product and understand. So if the issue was just with the graphics, then it's down to probably the art direction and how that was followed.
Well, you have one other trend with the Spider-Man games. They're never going to be visually on par with, say, a Gears of War or a Resistance Fall of Man, because Spider-Man has traditionally been an open-world game, and by going that route, it puts so many other constraints on the developer that there are some trade-offs that, as developers, we have to make. And that might be, you know, what the guy's referring to is that difference in style.
His particular example, not so much, because Web of Shadows is more of 2D. Well, it's not really 2D, but it's not exactly open world. No, it's actually reminds me of Battletoads, believe it or not, like back in the day. But
Battletoads
anyway,
is awesome.
It doesn't matter. You're right. You guys aren't involved in the game, so it's hard to give specific responses to an open question like this. But
okay.
We're at the end of our show, so I certainly appreciate your time.
I actually got one thing that I would like to, if you guys could humor us for just a while longer. So I saw a really interesting interview with Gabe Newell about becoming a game developer. And, you know, on this show, we sometimes dispense advice on how to get into the industry. And this comes from, you know, primarily, you know, my personal experience. But he said something in an interview that kind of contradicts something that I've always believed. So I'm wondering if I could just, I'm going to read a quote and then maybe you guys could comment on it.
We've got 1 minute left.
Okay, so this is going to be really fast, right? So he was talking about basically like specialization and getting a job, right? And so he said specialization and hierarchy are the norms in film production, and they're antithetical to what needs to happen in the game industry. So basically, I've always said that, okay, well, it's important for you to show a specialization because that's what's going to get you hired. He's saying maybe it's not so important. What do you guys think?
I don't think it's so important.
He agrees with Gabe.
Okay. All right.
All right. Well, end of show.
Pretty much we don't have much time. Look at that.
I am wrong sometimes. I admit it.
Right, gentlemen, I certainly appreciate it. Before we go, is there anything I should be pitching or pimping for you two?
Nerf and Strike in shops this week.
Say that one more time.
Nerf and Strike on the Wii in your shops this week.
Nerf and Strike.
Yeah.
There you go.
For the Wii. I should try that myself.
Fantastic.
Then. All right, well,
thanks, we're at
the end of the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, guys, for coming on.
Thanks, guys, for having us.
Yep, have a good night to our listeners and to our guests. And don't forget to go to uat.edu, the website for University of Advanced Technology, our wonderful sponsor that I needed to mention one more time before the end of the day. We will let you know on the website next Tuesday whether or not we're actually going to be on the air next Tuesday.
Good night, guys.
You've been listening to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. Tune in next week for more tips and info and the latest and greatest in video gaming. And remember, all your base are belong to us.